Copy, shift box.
Okay, radio check. Yeah, radio's working fine.
Yeah, call your personnel.
Yeah, copy, mate.
The chair in the vent bag.
Yeah, stitcher up there, thanks, mate.
Righto, JD, one of your predictions that I thought was 100% going to come true hasn't come true. You can't be good at everything.
Well, we did say the asset would get sold.
Yes.
We did specify a buyer. We were wrong on the buyer.
I mean, but
would never have picked this buyer. Money Miners, you want to know what we're talking about? Hang on, mate. We've got... We're getting into Liontown today because they've fired the first cut, and we're going to talk about the ramp up, the underground, and what we're looking for. Exciting to talk about some lithium getting broken instead of just of the ground just getting sold and traded. So that's good. We're going to talk about there's been a big copper mine company sold, purchased.
Yep.
Very good deep dive for you boys. 249D Northern Minerals is...
It's not your usual 249D that I get interested in, but there's a really interesting angle to this one, Matty.
Mm. Now, and there's a couple of that popped out to me that I'm here to look after the retail punter. And
as you told me, Matty, you're doing God's work.
I'm doing God's work, and I've got Trav on the case for me to sort of figure out what the hell was going on, and he's done a great job. Right.
Perfect.
Boys, I'm just going to bring up a little picture here to get the show rolling. Have a look at that. We're getting cartoons
sent
into
us. This is quite artistic.
Cartoons.
Mm. This your drawing, Manny?
It's not. I don't have that talent. But talking about talent, these two ladies here, they're called Helen and Celeste. Celeste is also known as Best in the West. What do you think they're doing?
It looks like they're scouring Australia with magnifying glasses. My guess is looking for tenements that need compliance.
Without knowing that, would have you guessed that, Bart?
Of course.
Of course. That is exactly what they're doing. That is Helen and Celeste from MMTS. Bit of a metaphor for what the organisation does. They are literally looking at Australia with a magnifying glass, and as soon as a bloody tenement comes online, they will notify their full-service clients. Absolute wheelers and dealers in tenement managed packages there, because they've got, and this has been orchestrated by who they call the magician, their in-house software guru. Yeah.
We've heard about this.
And this is how they get this info immediately. It's like pretty much like when we put a YouTube episode up, notification, tenement available, because apparently WA seconds matter if you want. It's a bit of a first-in-time sort of thing to get a hold of mining tenements. So absolute gurus. If we can get the real MMTS, Eva, Helen, Shannon, send us the real life photo of this as well. We'll put them side by side. So, mate.
And that's not all they do, right?
Mate, they do shitloads, JD. I'm talking everyday model, mining title compliance, title applications and acquisitions, support with land access, title approvals, shitloads more. Again, too hard to worry about. That's why you get gurus like this to do it. MMTS.
Legends.
Cheers.
Can I share one fun fact about them before you wrap up, Matty? And that's that you mentioned they help with tenement applications and acquisitions. I remember when we first met them, I asked the question, you know, because when good tenements become available, have you ever considered, you know, getting in the business of acquiring tenements and vending them? And I loved their answer.
No.
Their answer was no. You're either a client to... You either provide a service to your clients, or you're competing with them if you're doing that. And they take the view of, no, we're bloody providing a service. We're not going to get in that business.
Like us, independent.
Legends.
Independent. That's what we love. Mate, big news out before we get in. The federal government passed some legislation last week. So at the beginning of 2024 to 2025, that era, large Australian companies and financial institutions are going to be required to disclose their climate risks under new Australian sustainability reporting standards. Finance companies have got to...
What does that mean?
Well, I don't know. it sounds like a shitload of work. And this is where Future Proof Consulting comes in.
Matty, we
absolute gurus in this space.
We had a very real example, and it's pretty awful how it's played out in Panama lately. We spoke about Cobre Panama, and the ESG has just not been handled in a good fashion at all, and the results have been pretty shocking. So Not saying that that's going to happen if you don't do your reporting, but do your reporting, speak with the guys at Future Proof, so you're on the front foot with this stuff, and something like that doesn't happen.
Well, First Quantum, we're not future-proofed.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, there is a risk that if you don't engage Future Proof to get them to do this for you, your market cap will halve, like First Quantum. It's an investment risk. I recommend you take action, and it's better to start this process early and build up capacity rather than scrambling at the last minute, boys.
Just pick up the phone and give Ben a call.
Benny Swan is the he is ESGC, you would say. An absolute ESGC. So, right, as we said, ESG, it's like the modern day, it's like tax.
Right.
You have to pay it. You have to do it, whether you like it or not. And who does your tax? An accountant. Ben Swan is the ESG accountant. You awesome. Go to him, he sorts it all out for you. Cheers, Future Proof. Love your work. Thanks for keeping market caps where they are.
On you, Benny.
Good Maddie, stuff. You've got a bit of a deep dive, which is very much in your wheelhouse.
Did on it. This is one of my deep dives that no one has asked for, not even you two, but I've just gone out and done it, so whatever.
All right, get us up to speed.
I guess what drew me attention, floating around Facebook and LinkedIn, the first cut of the Liontown, one of the many Liontown portals was taken. Check it out. And then, mate, this is one of the best bloody videos I've ever seen of a cut firing. Have a look at it.
Ooh.
The GoPro's still alive somehow. Then they got the drone footage up there as well. Look at the detail. Look at that go off.
Oh, that's wicked.
So we got to.
It's like fireworks.
On the jumbo too. And charge up and shit, you got to figure out what's going on inside the smoke. But you soon figure it out. Look at that. There you go. First cut. That's so that'll wicked. Be probably I'd say that'll be about a 3 meter round or something, because the ground's usually pretty shit at the start of your cuts from the pit blasting and close to the surface. So it's not like a normal 4.5 meter round. So, but yeah, now I thought now that's been fired, and as I said, excited that there's going to be some bloody lithium getting broken that we can talk about instead of just ownership changes. I thought let's go in to what we're going to look out for. Like, I guess we've seen a bit of the CapEx blowout with Liontown, the stuff that we're going to be looking for and everyone else is going to be looking for on the ramp up and in production. Mm-hmm. And why? What are the risks? What are the big ones? What are the smaller ones?
You're putting your mining hat on and you're going to just explain how you pragmatically see some of the key risks. It's a bit novel what they're doing, and it's bold, and there's risk associated with that.
It's novel, but it's on a bigger scale than most underground mines. So we're going to I'm excited to see this project going. There's a lot of people working frigging hard, and geez, talk about having all the eyeballs on you.
Yeah.
So I feel for you. Glad it's not me. Right, CapEx blowout that has been heavily publicised, you'd say. You'd attribute it to, look, inflationary pressures, like from when the initial, like the DFS come out in 2021, a lot's happened since then with inflation. That's a big cause. The processing as well, that DFS come out with, it had a DMS, a dense media separation, then went into flotation. But the actual plant that's been built, I think they term it holable flotation. So there's essentially no DMS circuit. All the feed goes into a big, massive flotation circuit. So that 3 to 4 million tonne, that whole feed is going through flotation. So much bigger scale of flotation,
right?
Which is
more
that
CapEx.
Would have contributed to a lot of the CapEx. Like to compare it to, say, I've heard this secondhand, but Pilgangoora, the Pilgam plant, the main one, about 30% of the feed or the lithium comes out of the DMS circuit, and then about 70 goes into the flotation. So in this, like, which means you don't have to have as big a flotation capacity because you're already taking a bit out in the DMS. Whereas this case, this is why the flotation is much bigger. 100% is going through flotation.
What's the benefit of removing the DMS?
Well, it's one, you get it earlier because every process step is a potential recovery loss.
Yeah,
you can
more
potentially
loss,
lose. Yeah. And then obviously because it's all going through flotation, much bigger scale, much bigger CapEx.
Yeah.
DMS is like, it's like your gravity goal, get it out quick, get it out easy.
Yeah.
That's your easy shit to get out. Whereas so it must be, the Liontown material must be all pretty fine grained. I would imagine if it's gone mass.
Optimising for greater recovery.
Yeah, obviously. So I'm not 100% sure on that. The scopes increased a lot by the sound. So because they changed, remember they changed, they had the two open pits and then they, I think it was earlier this year, they said they'll stop and doing the Mount Man, I think it was, open pit and then just chucking a box cut in straight away. So they...
Was that related to the change in DSO strategy or was this a separate decision?
I think the DSO was still on the table then. I'm not sure.
Yeah, the DSO.
It was to get to the underground stuff quicker.
Gotcha.
Higher grade stuff quicker.
Yeah, and there was other issues relating to getting the, you know, open pit mining title versus an underground is a different process.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and so less, I think, and that's a big thing with, you know, right next door to Bellevue. So exactly. Native title was probably one of the most important things. And that's, they could have mined this as a massive open pit. And I think that was one of the early
considerations. Yeah.
But more the underground native is obviously way less surface disturbance. DFS said there was four declines going in, so three surface ones and I think it was one internal decline. They're now putting six declines in, so six portals. There's two sets of up and down declines, so that's four, and then you got a return airway, one each side, so that's for ventilation. So
what's comparable? Does anywhere else in Australia have six?
Off the top of it. Not sure. I'm sure there is. Some of the big ones.
But you've worked mostly gold mines, which don't have.
But you've got some big fucking gold mines like bloody Cadia and.
Yeah.
But then it gets Cali into what the mining method is.
Yeah. It's but
and how the ore body sits, whether you can use a shaft.
A lot of them, whether you want to put the capital in for a shaft. I think this one's pretty spread and. I think it's like an S shape, so I don't think a shaft would have worked here, or you could have put multiple in. So the downside of this is more declines, more capital development, but the upside is because you've got these twin declines, so it sounds like each ore body's got a down decline, so trucks go down one decline and then come back up the other one, so it's like a continuous trucking loop. So because if you're going up at the one, you got to pull over for that bastard coming down. Yeah. The one going down pulls over for the one coming up, and you're always stop and start and congestion. So this is a good thing for them to reach this 3 to 4 million ton run rate because it is extra capital, but that's you'd want to spend that to guarantee they're going to hit that haulage nameplate, which everyone's talking about. Mm-hmm. That's a risk of getting that amount of dirt out of the hull. Any more, Trav, you reckon there's any more CapEx blowouts to come here?
I don't know. I think there was a lot of padding baked into the numbers that eventually got flushed to the market. Like the debt and equity package that sort of came out was a lot higher than people had been, you know, forecasting for what they need for CapEx. So I think they put padding in it just to have a bit of safety. But having said that, I'm just not close enough to know what the real cash flow dynamics are like there. I think the mark would be pretty disappointed if there were more to come. And I think there's plenty of different entities floating about with various interests, you know, who might have an incentive to have a story put forward where there are going to be more CapEx blowouts. But I just don't know how real that sort of conjecture is.
Yeah. So I guess now I want to talk about, what the biggest things to watch out for during the ramp up. And by ramp up, I'm talking like the first 2 years. There's so many different levels of ramp up. Big things to watch out for. It's a massive underground contract, a lot of moving parts, a lot of jumbos required. I think they're getting 9 jumbos there, so that's a lot of operators trying to get skillful operators to be on the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th and 9th jumbo. That's always a challenge. Look, it's right next door to Bellevue. We know it's well publicised, the hardness of the ground at Bellevue, so I'd be interested to see if the Kathleen Valley ground is very hard as well. Hard ground, slower development rates, tough on consumables, delays you getting to that first stope because that's what you need. You need to get to the ore as quick as you can, get all your capital development in your levels. You need to get to the ore so you can start drilling it and start firing. You see when I'm talking underground, I start talking like I'm back underground. Fucking exciting. Love it. And then obviously once they start stoping, will they get that 3 to 4 million ton run rate?
So you'll be keeping a close eye on how the decline is going over the next coming quarters, because it gives you a good indication of whether they're going to have, you know, hiccups getting to that ultimate thing. Because this is still construction, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Ramp up's still a while away.
Yeah, and you want to be looking at what's the average meters 9 jumbos are getting. One might be, Oh, and that's the thing. It's all development, so it shouldn't be. There shouldn't be much rehab or anything, because rehab usually comes about once stoping commences. So it's all just flat stick develop. I think Nine would be once full production. They're not there straight away. I think from July next year, it really bloody ramps up. But look, bloody burn cutter on the job. I know, bloody, I know, I'll suck them off a bit. But tell you what, they're the bloody, they're the best. Oh, bloody, a lot of respect for that company. So yeah. You've got the right, right people for the job. To execute a big contract there. Now, the paste, it's a paste-fill operation. So it's not a nice and easy open pit. You just create a big hole, make it bigger and bigger, and you don't have to put anything in it until you finish it and sell it and it's someone else's problem. It's all good at the start.
Yeah.
Paste-fill isn't an issue at the start because there's a bit of breathing room. So getting that nameplate, that 3 million tonne, I think they're starting at, getting that in the as soon as you start. Trav's nearly knocked the bloody thing over. Jeez, you're right. You hit your funny bone.
You're cracking me up, mate.
Oh, buddy. So when you start firing stubs, getting the nameplate at the start's not the biggest issue because they'll probably develop. They'll have numerous mining fronts open. They'll just start dropping stubs. There'll be dirt everywhere and then all good. They're called the primary stopes. And then it's when they get to the secondary stopes when the issue. So definition. Do you know what a primary and a secondary stope is, boys?
You quizzed me yesterday. I was very proud of myself for guessing this one.
You got it right. I was very proud.
I had, full disclosure, Maddie, at the start of the year, I had no appreciation for paste fill. Like I just didn't.
Well, same as me with finance.
But my guess was that secondary stopes are the one you take the primary ones first, and then the secondary ones you can take after you paste fill the primary stopes.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if they're doing a retreat or a like primary secondary like method, but pretty much once you can take out like all your primaries, but then you've got it once they're bogged out, then you've got to start paste filling them. Then between those stopes, look like I'm holding a set of somethings. Between that. Is they're your secondary stopes. So to mine those secondary stopes, you have to have one, you have to have the mill running well because you need to be producing, you need to have it running consistently because you need to be producing the tailings that feed into the paste plant. So you need the mill running well. You then need the paste plant to perform well. You need the reticulation going underground to be performing well. So a bit of context, when we turned the paste on for the first time ever to fill the first stope at De Grusa, turned it on, nothing come out, blocked the whole line. And then we spent days, like close to a week probably, with long holes, rattling, sledgehammers, like drilling out the frickin', like it would have been over a kilometre worth of line to unblock it.
And what blocked it? What caused the block?
Oh, it was the first ever pour, probably not That was De Grusa was a difficult one because it was sulfides and different, it's like binder instead of cement. Like it was difficult to get the paste strength. It was a difficult one. But yeah, like just
stuff could go wrong.
The first stuff can shit can hit the fan. So I line town. I bloody hope to God that that doesn't happen to you guys, but it can happen. So that's a risk. Like even so, then you've got to get it obviously. All that happening and get the stopes filled, they've got a cure, and then which means they've got a set for, you know, I think it was like 1 or 2 weeks because it's got to be hard enough so it doesn't all go to shit. So, that might be, I don't know, 9 to 18 months after they first production,
right?
Maybe a year before they actually get to those, start having secondary stopes in the system because it might turn out like nifty. Nifty was the case where the paste plant didn't work well. They just couldn't fill the stopes as quick as they were mining them. I don't think they even filled half of them. And there was open holes everywhere. You can't access all the ore in the middle and they had a thing self-mined to the surface. So the most important thing in a paste fill operation is the balance between the paste going in and the dirt coming out of the stopes. Because if you're mining quicker than you're filling, you will get to some point where your mill – you just because you can only supply the paste with the dirt that's coming out of the hole. So once you get behind, the only way you can catch up is to get an extra source of feed, like start chucking cemented rock fill in and bloody, or you can put waste in the middle of the paste fill stopes. If they set it up right and they're big stopes, you can actually create like passes where you can get the waste from the bottom of the mine and dump that into the middle of the stope. So because the walls are all still covered in paste, but you've got rock in the middle, which doesn't matter. So it saves you on paste. So big, yeah, big, that whole it's a big loop. Continuous loop that needs to be, yeah. So that and that'll be, but that might be a year, year and a half away until that is realised that that's all running in unison very well.
Yeah.
So my thoughts, Matty, would be that they'll have the primary stopes firing, and then they're going to have the what could be a very real issue of commissioning the plant and getting that humming before a potential
So there's a lag between commissioning, like the mill commissioning, getting the mill going, then the paste, because they mightn't need it. They don't need it until they've finished the first stope.
Yeah. So there's more in terms of getting the recoveries and the cash. Yeah. Ultimately. Well,
look, and that's the next bit. Because we know what they say, Pilgangoora, 18 months till they fine-tuned that whole flotation circuit. Now, this one is holable flotation, so that the whole circuit is relying on flotation. So, look, if you discount probably Core Lithium with their troubles they had with DMS, that was due to the fine-grained material, but it sounds, from what I've heard, a lot of the lithium ramp-up dramas have always... A lot of it's been the flotation.
Takes a while to get it right.
Yeah. So that's going to be big one. Don't even know why I write all these notes. I didn't even read half of them.
I think on the plus side, the amount of like funding that they got in through the debt and equity package recently, there was the number surprised us to the upside, but probably to give them the padding to work through, you know, whatever obstacles. I mean, you don't want to plan down to the wire. You don't want to be cutting it thin and have no room for error. Mm. I think they've overcapitalized to have, you know, room for buffer for things that can be unforeseen but challenging, such as the base not coming out when you first fall.
Yeah, no, you'd hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Best of luck. But another thing, I'll just about that primary secondary thing, just to be clear, they're not going to get to the stage they're just mining secondary stopes. There's always new levels opening up and new areas that'll open up new primary stopes. There'll always be a blend until you get to like the end of the mine life when bloody, you're not at levels. It's all, there's always new areas open up, but you will start relying on some secondary stopes. So I'm excited. I can't wait to see it in action. Can't wait to see the bloody.
Yeah.
That'll be a quarterly report I'll be looking forward to every time.
And how many new underground mines have, you know, been constructed or commissioned since we started this podcast? I don't think, I mean, like Bellevue was an existing underground mine, so I wouldn't put it in the same category.
Yeah,
this is you know, a greenfields like development.
Had Galena been in action for long? It had already been going for a bit.
I think
it had already started.
I think it had started.
Oh, only just.
But yeah.
It was one of the very first months.
I think we got first production there.
Yeah.
What else has there been? Underground.
Gee, I don't know.
Pantora had been going for a while.
But even that underground was existing.
King of the Hills was existing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, greenfields.
It's exciting for you, Matty. Exciting.
Oh, mate. I love it. And look, as I said, there's some people working bloody hard. I just want to – nothing more than I'd love to see them execute on this without many – there's always going to be hiccups. There's always going to be ramp-up issues, but I wish them all the best. It's exciting for the industry.
Agreed.
Right, the copper mine.
Hey.
What is the copper mine? What is the transaction? Who's buying who, JD?
Matty, Khoemacau is being sold to MMG. So they would be – they'd be familiar to a couple of listeners because – they own a couple assets in Australia. So they're a roughly $4 billion capped miner. They're a Chinese group, so they're quoted on the Hong Kong exchange, Chinese company. So, I mean, to start with, it's surprising how little has been written about this transaction, given it's only happened this morning, but it's pretty huge. On the headline number, US $1.875 billion, it's a pretty chunky transaction. So we'll give a bit of scope on Khoemacau, the asset. We've, you know, alluded to it in the past. I said as one of my predictions that Sandfire and S32 would buy it, but they, you know, put themselves out of the running a couple months back now.
Never would have thought of MMG, like just...
No.
Yeah, because they're more probably bait, like...
I mean, the mines they have here, Dugald, zinc.
Yeah, they're a lot of lead zinc sort of deposits.
And it's a big bite for them, for a $4 billion company to be buying something for almost $2 billion US. Is pretty substantial.
Are they listed anywhere?
Yeah,
Hong Kong Stock Exchange.
Yeah. So the asset Khoemacau is in the Kalahari Copper Belt in Botswana, which, you know, by and large people consider a pretty good jurisdiction. and it's currently producing 60,000 tonnes per annum of copper and 1.6 million ounces of silver. So we'll get into the presentation that they put out, but as Trav noticed, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of green lights. It's going to be huge. It's going to be this massive thing. This is only stage one. They're talking about 130, 150, and then 250,000 tonnes per annum of copper underground, Matty. So a big thing.
Well, we've got some videos to show throughout, which are pretty bloody cool.
And that would be as well as, you know, 5 million plus ounces of silver per annum. So the high-grade portion of the resource sits at 166 million tonnes at 2% copper. Bless you, Matty.
Pardon, mate.
And 26 grams per tonne silver. So 3.6 million tonne per annum plant currently.
Big.
Big. And on the front of silver, that's actually been streamed out. So they got a lot of cash in the door in 2019. And a stream, as a quick reminder, is giving someone essentially the right to buy your silver or whatever. You know, we've seen in the case of the CSA mine selling the byproducts there as well at a much marked down price. So they're going to be selling the silver at 20% of whatever the spot price is at the time. Gotcha. And that's up to a 40 million ounce limit and then 50% of production thereafter.
Mm. But the parties that enacted the stream were the owners, well, which are the sellers,
yep,
being a combination of private equity.
Yeah, two different private equity. So GNRI and local RCF here were 88.1% and 11.9% owners of the asset. It might be familiar to a lot of punters that have been around a bit longer than us, because this asset was originally in the hands of Discovery Metals, which had, you know, lofty takeover bids, which they pushed back over a decade ago, and then they eventually fell over. This private equity consortium came and scooped up the asset. So that said, you know, people might remember that they bought it for a pretty low, like a $35 million value, but that wasn't the asset in its entirety. And since then, over $1 billion has gone into the ground. So they've had to work for the return that they're getting. A couple of the assumptions that they put out, MMG, that is, around the mine is quite interesting. The way the whole announcement is structured is a bit different to ones we read, and I'd assume that's to do with regulations on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. But they talk about getting this thing to between 8.1 and 8.5 million tonnes per annum in 5 or 6 years' time.
Another, it's a long way from where it is right now.
Absolutely, mate. They're going to spend another $700 to $800 million in capex, US dollars that is, 27-year mine life, 1.8% grade copper, 88% recoveries, you know, reaching by 2029 about 150,000 tonnes of copper at a C1 cost of US $155 per pound. And lastly, $100 million US in sustaining costs per annum.
And you look at the video we'll chuck up now, like just looks like just some massive, deep. The way those pictures were, I thought they look like jumbo drives, but it's just because it's so bloody deep. Like there's, you know, 60, 20 metres stopes, that's your 1,200 metres.
Yeah,
like
it's huge, three box cuts into, and that's just zone five. So that's not even including the other deposits that sit in and around the area.
It looks like a dream to mine. Just looks nice and bloody easy. Anyway, it looks good on video.
it always does.
Easy from the podcast chair.
All right, let's get into a couple takeaways. Trav, you got the first one on how they sort of dressed up the presentation and the announcement.
Yeah, I think we'll chat about the valuation as well, right? Like you said, it was a funny announcement to read from MMG. You read it, and three of the first seven pages are literally devoted to articulating how MMG come up with its DCF valuation, and they provide all the assumptions and all of the forecasts used. You don't often see that. They do reference like compliance with a listing rule, which I assume relates to the Hong Kong listing, but I still found it strange. Like I haven't seen kind of the breakdown of the assumptions used in so much detail. I sort of read it and think, are they trying to convince me that they've actually not overpaid for this by providing all this detail? But
the cynical take.
Yeah. And I mean, you look at the valuation, they pay $1.9 billion US. And there's this funny paragraph. I've got to pull it out, and I think we've got to have a chat about it because it's a stupid paragraph. But they basically say that if you take that acquisition price and you add on the future expansion capital and you look at what they predict EBITDA will be after that expansion capital is spent, then on an EV EBITDA multiple, the acquisition's 4.3 times EBITDA. And then they say that that is below the current average trading multiples of comparable global base metals mining peers. I hope, so Matty and JD.
Is that saying they sold it to cheap? I bought it cheap.
So this is written by the buyer.
Yeah. They're trying to convince us that they've, you know, got a good deal.
Got a good deal.
Yeah.
I hope the money miners by now know why this is a stupid metric. I think it's a bit of an insult to the intelligence of the investment community out there, because they're comparing projected EBITDA in FY29 with current trading multiples for, you know, one year out. It's just dumb. I'm losing brain cells reading it.
It's so stupid. You got to put in all your assumptions. The thing is, you know, 5 or 6 years away, it's their assumption on EBITDA. It's their low end of guidance on what the expansion capital is going to cost. I mean, let's talk about an EV to EBITDA multiple on the earnings next year and the year after. I mean, you're getting this sort of optionality, but it's coming at a tremendous cost with a lot of risk attached. Like, you want to know what you're buying right now.
So it's like the scoping study we talked about where present value CapEx prices were used and future value commodity prices were used in a way.
Yeah, you're comparing apples with oranges instead of apples with apples. If you want to compare apples with apples, compare the EBITDA it did, you know, or the forward-looking EBITDA next year with comps for the forward-looking EBITDA next year, not one with the other, right? And if you do that, they paid 13 times EBITDA. Compare that with a global average, which I'm guessing their pool gets an average of about 4.5 times. I just think we should be honest with how we present numbers rather than...
That's what you're here for, Trav. You sort that out, because I wouldn't have picked that up. So, yeah, thank God for you two.
And there seems to be, you know, on the broader context of copper, you know, companies, copper transactions and the copper price, a bit of a disconnect. The copper price is, you know, just hanging about, not doing awfully great. We had that chat with Benny Hooper and got into details there. But then you see the multiples that these transactions are going on, they're pretty lofty. So people aren't sinking capital in the ground to really develop a lot of these things. They're buying them at expensive prices. So, I mean, it's kind of, I don't know what the real takeaway, where we go with that, but it's not a cheap multiple by any means. And you're getting this sort of optionality, like I said, but it's coming at a pretty significant cost.
Yeah. You see this like articulated often in sell side materials, and that's that like high quality assets attract a premium valuation, and your financial metrics don't necessarily capture that, but they, you know, they'll get a premium when they do sell. I'm not sure if this fits that category, but.
Overall, do you think buying a massive operation like that looks like it's going to be bloody mining for a very long time going into a copper market? Do you think what they paid for it today is a good deal?
I'd rather be the seller.
$2.4 billion or whatever.
I'd rather be the seller personally than the buyer in this one. Like you know my rule. Never buy from private equity.
True. Yeah. So, and that, a lot of that's to do with the future CapEx that has to go into it as well.
Yeah, it's a competitive process. Private equity know how to sex things up. They'll, you know, make it look great, and you'll end up, you know, it'll be very competitive. They'll draw in all the parties. Everyone will get like itchy fingers and think, fuck, I can't let this one go. And it'll get bid up to the max, and you'll pay a price where you kind of price for perfection. And it's a competitive sale process. Also, the sellers have way better information on the future because they've been operating it than you do. And they decided to sell it now. You know, so like it's not just an operational consideration, but there are market considerations that go into it. I'm not saying every time that private equity is sold to someone that that party has done poorly. But as a general rule, I don't want to buy private equity's bags.
Private equity have done their numbers on it.
They know how to sell something for a top price.
They know how to do numbers. They definitely sexed it up. There's a lot of marketing material on the website and everything.
Yeah. Well, a lot of nice pictures, hey?
100%. That was I looked at the like Comic Yow have its own website, and you look at the investor presentation on there, and there's a lot of you know upside cases and stuff like that that are, you know, gets much bigger than things are today, and that's the sort of materials you bake into a sale process. I'm not saying that shouldn't be your base case. Well, I probably am, but I think, you know, when you have a sale process and you're selling an asset, what do? You provide bidders with an information memorandum. It's basically this investor presentation, and you build in these you know, mind plan scenarios that you want the bidders to anchor towards, which you also want to be as bloody blue sky as possible so that they anchor against the highest possible thing. So what do? You chuck in all of your growth cases. Here's the expansion capex. It's going to get bigger. It's going to deliver more financial returns. And you hope that your bidder pool anchors to that number rather than, you know, the status quo, which is, you know, no expansion. And hence you see some kind of lofty forecasts in what the operation can do and all that sort of stuff. Like you said, JD, the optionality is real. But the materials that you read, I was like, oh, this reminds me of, like sale process materials. And it was on a Comical website there. And it even triggered a little bit of a memory back to Sandfire's marketing when they acquired Matza. You kind of saw they talked about phase one, you know, delivering here's what we're doing in years, in year one, here's what we're doing in years 2 to 5. And that's, you know, expansion. And then years 5+, there's more expansion on top of that. So people start baking in these expansion cases into their base case on the financial model and can back solve and talk themselves into paying top dollar. And the optionality is real, but it's just, yeah, I just always get a bit cynical when I think of people's rationalization in that way.
I feel, Trav, I feel like that's a rant that you needed to get out of your system.
There's one more take to, you know, put in on this one, and that's, again, we're speaking about a Chinese group buying a significant asset, you know, in Africa, and not just in Africa, but globally, a significant asset. Like, my only comment would be that there is a lot of talk from the West about how important copper is, but it still seems that the Chinese groups are the ones actually taking action and buying these sorts of assets. So I wonder when we see that change.
Mm.
Guys, a 249D, an unusual 249D at Northern Minerals.
That's funny when you say an unusual 249D. It must be, because they're pretty unusual to start with.
They are. This one's particularly spicy from a geopolitical sense.
It's where geopolitical battleground meets shareholder activism. It's juicy. For those who don't know, Northern Minerals is a developer of heavy rare earth project, Browns Range in Western Australia. Heavy rare earths being D, Y and TB. Do you know what they are, Matty?
Dysprosium and terbium. It's
well done, mate. Well done.
So they're the ones doing, they're shipping the concentrate to Eneabba, aren't they?
Well, they, not yet, but that's what they've agreed.
That was the plan.
They inked the deal with Iluka where they agreed to provide feed to the refinery being built by Iluka. I think that's still a few years away from being constructed. But 8 months ago, interestingly, Treasurer Jim Chalmers moved to prevent Yu Zhao Fund from increasing its stake in Northern Minerals.
That sounded bloody China.
9.8% to 19.9%. So, the like federal government FIRB getting in the way here, preventing this Chinese linked fund. The corporate entity is based in Shanghai, but there's Chinese links to Yu Zhao Fund. 1 month ago, though, Northern Minerals asked FIRB to pry into some share buying in their stock, which they suspected it to be from parties which have links to Yu Zhao Fund. Of course, this would be contrary, if true, to the FIRB outcome previously, which sought to restrict Yu Zhao's ownership to sub 10% levels. FIRB's investigations here are still ongoing, and as such, Northern Minerals AGM has actually been allowed to occur 3 months later than usual. They sort of waiver to have that happen, and that's how it's going. And Yu Zhao had put resolutions chucked in at this AGM to vote on the nomination of a Chinese businesswoman at the AGM, and now obviously that's been postponed, so 3 months later. And there are also two other candidates nominated as well by some shareholders, which Northern Minerals management suspects are also linked to Yu Zhao. So with that AGM delayed, it seems to me like Yu Zhao is trying to force a vote to occur sooner by requisitioning a vote via Section 249D. This is really intriguing, right? They want to oust the chairman, Nicholas Curtis, who, by the way, was OG Linus Nicholas Curtis, and they want to inspect the books of the company to review the legality of Mr. Curtis's conduct in his duties as director and officer. The company is still considering if this 249D is valid. I think it's a fascinating story. Normally, I look at the 249D and I side with the grumpy, you know, grumpy
default
shareholders, because I think, oh, they're bloody upset. Nothing's been done at this company. This is just different, right? This is complicated. We're talking strategically important and rare critical minerals. A Chinese-linked entity looking to exert influence at the company level. Allegations of breaches of a prohibition order from FIRB. If the Yu Zhao linked parties have been buying its It's complex.
There you go. I'm going to listen back to that. I swear you started using a Chinese accent on some of those words. It was real Chinese on the other ones as well. Yeah, no, we'll keep an eye on that. Speaking of something I had my eye on yesterday, and I thought I need Ricciardo to go balls deep into this because I'm like, right, what's going on here? Charger Metals, CHR, I think it is. So it was especially this morning, they went into trading up for a cap raise. But yesterday they announced a farming agreement with Rio Tinto, expiration, RTX they're called, for this their Lake Johnston lithium project. So it's a neurology play to that TG6. That one's gone from 10 cents to a buck just on 9 metres at 1.35% lithium. So another thin stacked pegmatite thing, but it's gone up because that is what lithium does these days.
And so did you see the trading halt after the announcement of the Rio and think, oh, something's fishy?
No, well, it was yesterday. So they announced this farm in, but then they went down 25% at the start of trade, around 25%.
Which you wouldn't expect when you have a farm in with Rio.
You wouldn't expect without a farm in. So they did purchase 25% from Lithium Australia to get the 100%, but now Rio's farming in. There was a convertible note. They were putting all this – so what they were going to – they're paying $500,000 bricks and investing $1.2 million in charges. So that $1.2 is a convertible note. They can spend another they've got to spend $3 million on exploration the first 12 months. They can then earn – Rio Tinto exploration can then earn 51% by – chucking another $10 million in exploration plus another $1.5 million, then they can earn 75% by sole funding another $40 million in exploration and completing a DFS.
Gotcha. So you're thinking
– Rio just pumping the cash into them. I'm like –
well, that will pump the cash into the ground.
Into the ground,
but there's a small amount allotted that goes actually into the corporate entity. But you're saying, okay, here's a commitment from Rio to potentially spend a lot of money in the ground, and yet the share price
has gone down. And then it's like now they've gone into a trading halt. Okay, why are they – why for a capital raising, why are they then raising money when Rio Tinto is going to be essentially paying for a lot of the exploration? And then I saw like the links between this Lithium Australia and Charger. You've got the Charger chairman, Adrian Griffin. So he was previously the manager director of Lithium Australia, but he's still on as a technical director on contract to Lithium Australia. So that's who they purchased the remaining bit of the project off. And then so, but Lithium Australia owns 15.5% of Charger. Adrian Griffin owns 4.5% of Charger. Then
Adrian
shit
Griffin going everywhere.
Also owns nearly 1.79% of Lithium Australia. So it's, I'm like, right, what is going on here? Now, I found it very interesting. Trav, I got you into it.
I had a look.
Break it down.
I was looking at the funding and I thought, I'm not quite sure. I think I was reading your notes. I was like, where's Matty going with this? So I looked at Charger's end of quarter cash. They closed the quarter with $2 million in cash. Now there's this agreement because like it involved Lithium Australia. Charger are paying $2 million to Lithium Australia as part of the agreement with Rio. They're sort of tying up the consolidation there. That 30% was not owned by Charger, but they're paying $2 million. So that leaves Charger with not much, right? $2 million cash, paying $2 million out. But like you said, Rio, as part of their consideration, are giving $500,000 in upfront cash to Charger and providing $1.2 million via a convertible note. So there's a bit of coin in the door for Charger to keep the lights on, even if Rio's doing all the exploration. However, look at the convertible. So on the announcement yesterday, there's this $1.2 million convertible with Rio. If you read the terms, I think the strategy was there in plain sight. So in the terms of that convertible note, the conversion price is stated to be equal to the issue price of any capital raising by Charger prior to the Charger shareholder meeting to vote on the LIT agreement. So the capital raising today, I kind of interpret that as Charger trying to lock in an elevated conversion price with Rio for the terms of that convertible note. Mind you, there was a lower bound of 25 cents in the terms there. And maybe that sentence can explain some of the sell-off that you saw on the announcement with Rio. I don't know if it was all of it. This is just, but like if there's an announcement with Rio, you expect that's positive news, but it sold off maybe because if you read the details there, you realize they're actually talking about raising money
before the AGM.
Yeah, ASAP ultimately is the read-through. So, you know, they come raise, they sell off. It's probably part of it. And then part of it's also, you know, selling the news event.
Oh, bloody good work, Trav. But, I like it.
And my takeaway on it all, Matty, is like I think they should have pursued a deal with Rio that maximised more upfront cash consideration so that they're not come raised straight away. Do a deal that leaves you funded and the market will reward you. Don't do a deal that leaves you needing to top up ASAP where it's even transparent in the terms of the convertible.
And they're only going to effectively end up with 25% of the project, the rate it's going. So that's
pretty standard for the farm.
Is that how it usually works?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then they'll have to buy them out for the remaining if it gets anywhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is there. So good work, Trav. Like it. Now, another one that popped up today. This is hot copper going off. Pure Resources announced 11% lithium in mica. Don't even worry about the last bit I said. Just look at the 11.7% lithium. Whoa.
There's nuance here, isn't
there? Right. Everyone, like, mate, hot coppers are high. This is the highest lithium results ever. Has to be a record. The punters are going off.
And it sounds too good to be true.
Let me go through it. First bit, they're just rock chips. So we always know rock chips aren't bloody God. Look at remember what was on talk. They had 6% rock chips, didn't they? Look what happened there. Then not drill core, but you go to the next page. Look at the mineral. So trifolite, lithophyllite. So it's not spodumene. It's this other stuff, this mica material, and which mica means, these lithium-bearing mica minerals, means bloody hard to process because these micas, the gang material, the non-lithium material, responds very similar to the lithium material in flotation. So it's essentially very, very bloody hard to separate and process. Similar to, like, I don't know if it's the same issue with lepidolite, but lepidolite is shit, spodumene's good. So it's not spodumene. The other bit, the lithium percent number. So when we always see announcements, they present it as lithium oxide percent, LiO2. You see, these ones are lithium percent. So to convert lithium percent to lithium oxide percent, you multiply it by 2.153. So that would mean that headline number is actually 25% lithium oxide. So it is a quarter lithium oxide. But I'll show you this graph here because remember spodumene, theoretically, like 100% spodumene, pure spodumene, can only be 8% lithium oxide.
Yeah,
so it cannot go higher than 8. It's like a bloody the infinite bound.
Yeah.
So if you look at this one, trifolite, the theoretical content is about 9.5% lithium oxide. So how the hell they've got assays for 25% lithium oxide, or the headline which was 11.7 lithium percent, I do not know. So I don't know what's happened there. It looks impossible. I'd like if anyone can correct me or the company can correct me, please tell me, because based on the theoretical chemical, it doesn't sound like it's possible.
Well done, Matty.
Overall, punters, trifolite, lithophyllite, they're pathfinder minerals for spodumene. So they do indicate that there might be more spodumene in the area, but they're not a very good thing to process. So watch out, punters. As I was halfway through doing this and got to the end, Trav says, oh, Dwayne Sparks did a thing on that. So I could have let out with that, but I did all the bloody work myself, so I don't want to give him the
full
credit.
Don't let him steal your thunder.
But he said it straight here. Unsure what is happening with this announcement. Maybe the libs need some calibration. 11.7% lithium converts to 25.2 lithium oxide. Theoretical value of trifolite and lithophyllite, or whatever you pronounce that, is approximately 4.4% lithium. I wouldn't mind finding some minerals that are a quarter lithium oxide. So he was onto it as well.
So, good on you, Matty. Yeah, you must be Dwayne Sparks.
I know. Is that your call out? Come meet Matt. Dwayne, is that like how you're going to get him in? Come meet Matt. He's a good bloke.
You just, yeah, great guys think alike.
Yeah, but anyway, that's what you, single-digit market caps, that's the sort of interesting stuff you see, AJ, do.
Great
work,
Matty.
Your wheelhouse.
Great work. I'll let you take those ones.
Righto. Thanks to all the partners for today. DSI Underground, Terra Capital, McMahon Mining Title Services, MMTS, Future Proof Consulting, with owner Ben Swan, the ESGC, Anytime Exploration Services, KCA Site Services, JP Search, Brooks Airways, and K-Drill. Boys, anything else?
Hooteroo.
Money Miners.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.